Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. About 2,500 years ago, an ancient Greek, born in what is now Turkey, traveled the Mediterranean looking to explain the origins of the Greeks' great Persian wars. From his travels and inquiry, Herodotus wrote the histories, history as it had never been told before, some of it fabulous in the tradition of fable and tall tale, much of it absolutely cutting edge, with an eye still relevant to our times. This hour, On Point, we're diving into a new translation of Herodotus and the roots of history itself. And let's just get the sound of this wonderful history in our ears. Here from the 1996 Oscar-winning film The English Patient, actor Kristen Scott Thomas's character, Catherine, tells a story from Herodotus while sitting with a group of explorers around a crackling Sahara desert fire. She recounts the racy story of Lydian King, who allowed his bodyguard, Gyges, to secretly see his naked queen. But the queen sees Gyges spying on her and is outraged.
And the next day, she sends for Gyges and challenged him. And hearing his story, this is what she said.
Off with his head!
She said, either you must submit to death for gazing on that which you should not, or else kill my husband who has shamed me, and become king in his place. So Gyges kills the king, marries the queen, and becomes ruler of Lydia for 28 years. The end.
Kristen Scott Thomas, 1996 in The English Patient, but of course, that's a story from 2,500 years ago in the great Herodotus and the histories. I'm sitting here with a great version of it right under my elbow. It's big, it's heavy, it is wondrous, and we're going to really dive into it today. Joining me now in the studio is Robert Strassler, a businessman long involved with the oil industry who took up a second career as a popularizer of ancient Greek texts. He studied the classics in college, turned back to them after a business career, after years of hard editing work, but with no academic credentials exactly. He published the landmark Thucydides in 1996. It sold more than 70,000 copies, a huge number for an ancient work. Now he's out with the landmark Herodotus. The New York Times praises it for its transparency and clarity. Duke's Andrea Purvis did the translation. Bob Strassler has pulled a lot more than that together. It's full of maps and charts and guides that make this 2,500-year-old text, often called the real work of history, feel brand new in many ways. Robert Strassler, Bob, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Tom.
It's so great to have you back and up to your eyeballs in this again. Thucydides was task enough and did wonderfully. Why did you go further back in history, beyond the Peloponnesian War? Why all the way back to Xerxes and the Greeks and the Persians and Herodotus?
Well, the two of them are the major classic historical works. If you do Thucydides and it's successful, people start to ask you, when are you going to do Herodotus?
Right.
And I put them off for a while, but when I found out nobody else was going to do it in that format, I decided, I don't know whether I was ill that day or had drunk too much, but I decided I would do it myself. And I didn't realize what a task it was going to be. I think if I had known how much more difficult it would have been to do Herodotus than it turned out to do Thucydides, I might have quailed before the challenge. But I did, not knowing, I forged in, and by the time I knew, it was too late to go back.
This edition brings Herodotus to life in such a wonderful, dimensional way. I wish you'd introduce to us just a little bit who this man was and what he set out to do in what's widely seen in the histories as the first of history.
Well, it's clear to a certain extent he was following Homer, who was also writing about, or Homer was reciting about great deeds by men long dead. And Herodotus lived after these Persian wars. He was born probably just after them. And
we're talking then in the 5th century B.C.
About 490, 485, mm-hmm. we're not sure when. Mm-hmm. And best I can describe his purpose by reading the opening paragraph of the book, if I could.
And we'll hear the echoes of Homer right here in the words of Herodotus.
Right. Herodotus of Halicarnassus here presents his research so that human events do not fade with time. May the great and wonderful deeds, some brought forth by the Hellenes, others by the barbarians, not go unsung, as well as the causes that led them to make war on each other. And that says it in a nutshell. That's what he was trying to do.
And he went wide and deep, looking very, very deeply for these causes that brought these two great cultures into conflict. You've got a photograph in the front of a wonderful marble bust of Herodotus. He looks kind of like an aging virgin, version of these New England Patriots, offensive linemen, Matt Light or Logan Mankins here with that great beard.
Of course, that's a Roman statue, and nobody really knows what he looks like. When he lived, you didn't have portrait statues made of Greeks. That was maybe 100 years later. But it was necessary in later times that we have pictures of Themistocles and Thucydides.
Yes.
And so the workshops that turned out busts of all the great people, not knowing, of course, what they looked like at all.
It was a Roman, I think Cicero, who called him the father of history.
That's correct.
Why, when did this become the consensus that Herodotus was the father of history, and what was it that set his work apart as something which, as you describe it, was new, history itself, a new undertaking?
Well, that's an interesting question. It's an epic in proportion. It starts about 575, 80 BC and goes all the way down to 480, about 100 years. It takes place all over the world. The Persian Empire extended from India to Turkey, from the Caucasus down to Ethiopia. It was a huge state, as big as any state that has been developed afterwards.
Centered basically not far from Baghdad today, Babylon, and between the Tigris and Euphrates.
All of that was under the control of the Persians. Mm-hmm. And so when he wrote about the development of the Persian Empire, which is how he begins, he spends hundreds of pages describing how they conquered Babylon, how they conquered Egypt, how they forayed into Scythia and failed to conquer it, and how they made a raid on Athens and Eretria, which failed at Marathon, and then mounted a major invasion, which collapsed at Plataea and the naval battle of Salamis. So all of this, hundreds of pages of backdrop and build-up, leads to these great battles at the end, and it has an epic sweep about it. Things get faster and faster. Last two books take place in just a year and a half, whereas the first ones take place over about 100 years. So it gets momentum, and it's well, beautifully written. He was a wonderful storyteller.
And as Rosalind Thomas reminds us in the great introduction to this translation, what he did at the time was revolutionary in the nature of the undertaking itself, not to turn this into verse or something to be poetry to be recited, but to really do something which was revolutionary, new history. What made it revolutionary?
Well, he was a creature of his time. This was the time of the great Greek flowering of intellectual capability. It's interesting to note that he came from the city of Halicarnassus in Turkey, which was under Persian control. So he grew up as a citizen of the Persian Empire. That means, in a way, that he was in contact with, or capable of being in contact with, all of the great knowledge of the East and Egypt, which otherwise Greeks knew nothing about. And so when he went to Athens or Corinth or Thebes and he talked about this great world, which he did, and it was exciting. It was fascinating. They were curious about these strange barbarians and their interesting knowledge that he brought. And one of the things that he helped to bring up about was the knowledge of geometry and medicine and all other elements of that we now would consider pre-scientific. But he used the language, and it's the first time that we know of it in anything like this, telling stories of people, the language of proof, the language of demonstration, the language he could show that this could not be so. He used all kinds of logical locutions that, in fact, were new at his time and are still part of our vocabulary and the way we think.
We'll talk about that, some fantastical things in here as well, but in that, the kind of idea of bringing proof to it, he began to bring history toward a kind of scientific approach. Rosalind Thomas writes that he sought the causes of the conflict, this great Greek-Persian conflict that was the shadowing enormous event before his life. He sought the causes in factors that took one back deep into the past and into the characteristics of each society. He implies that he saw the deep-seated causes in cultural antagonism of Greek and non-Greek, but, and here's the point, I guess, he went out of his way to describe the achievements and customs of many non-Greek peoples with astonishing sensitivity and lack of prejudice. This isn't just some champion of the Greeks standing up to say we're the best and they're all barbarians. He really paid attention to the world as he saw it.
Absolutely, and it is marvelous, and in a way it's Homeric. Homer, in order to have his heroes be wonderful and fabulous and terrific, had to have adversaries that were worthy. And so the Trojans aren't just barbarians. They are very worthy and capable barbarians. And in the same way, while he is definitely a Greek and is writing as a Greek in Greek, he has respect for the customs and the good features and the good elements of cultures that are quite un-Greek and which other Greeks probably disdained and couldn't bear. For example, if I can quickly, he spoke very in a cosmopolitan way about women. Now, in ancient Greece and in Athens, and other, if you remember, Pericles said about the widows, the best thing that could happen to you is that you go back into your homes and nobody talks about you for the rest of your life. The Greeks had an idea that women belonged in the home and that was all. They were not part of the common life.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the father of history, the ancient Greek Herodotus, and his fantastic world of wonders and marvels and the very real affairs of men and women and war that he wrote of to explain an entire era, a world as he lived it and saw it, and as maybe the world's first historian. My guest is Robert Strassler, businessman turned classics enthusiast and almost at this point a very sophisticated impresario. Became well known with the 1996 publication of the landmark Thucydides, which he edited. That volume sold more than 70,000 copies, a huge number for that kind of text. He's now out with the new volume, the landmark Herodotus. It's the histories of Herodotus, and it has all the maps and appendices you could ever ask for to understand a very different time from our own. Last year, of course, blockbuster Hollywood film 300 portrayed a battle between Spartans and Persians, a story that found its way into history largely through Herodotus. In this scene, the fictional character of Delios, played by David Wenham, recalls the inspiration taken from that battle between the Spartan king Leonidas and his small army and the Persian emperor Xerxes.
But from free Greek to free Greek, the word was spread that bold Leonidas and his 300, so far from home, laid down their lives, not just for Sparta, but for all Greece and the promise this country holds. Now, here on this ragged patch of earth called Plataea, Xerxes' hordes face obliteration!
And Hollywood has its way with Herodotus and the Greeks and Persians and Xerxes. Bob Strassler, did you wince or celebrate when 300 came out? The English Patient made Thucydides. I mean, Herodotus, very popular way back in its day. What about this?
I had to wince. It's it's not history. It's a great story. But Hollywood has a way of changing wonderful plots. I mean, they take a plot that's been good for 2,800 years and they add a love interest and they say, well, this one can't die. We have to have this happen and that happen. And they change it. And as far as I'm concerned, they ruin it. And I think it's a wonderful fantasy, but it's not history, the 300.
There's much we're going to delve into on Herodotus and history. I remember reading this all the way back in college. Donald Kagan was my professor on this, and he made it absolutely wondrous. You bring up women and the way Herodotus handled them. There's a little passage I wonder if you'd read here to do with Queen Artemisia of his hometown, Halicarnassus.
Yes, this is a passage drawn from Book 8. It takes place, as he's describing, the decisive naval victory of the Greeks over the Persians at Salamis. And he stops to tell this anecdote about Artemisia. The Greeks found it very, very difficult to take that a woman could lead in battle. And
remind us of how she of what her circumstances were that she was leading in battle.
She was a widow. Her husband had died. Her king had died. And she took over the realm under the Persian, with Persian approval. And she was commanding a small flotilla in the Persian Navy. And this describes an incident as she was in the battle herself, commanding her own warship. And it takes place in chapter 87. Mm. Here it begins. The king's fleet had reached a state of mass confusion, and it was during this crisis that Artemisia's ship was pursued by one from Athens. She was unable to escape it because there were so many other friendly ships in front of her, and since her own ship was closest to those of the enemy, she made a decision which turned out to be very much to her advantage. While she was still being chased by the Attic ship, she rammed at full speed a friendly ship manned by Calydians. Now, I cannot say if there was some quarrel she had with the Calydian king that had arisen while they were still near the Hellespont, or even whether, when she ran into the Calydian ship, the deed was premeditated or accidental. But when she rammed it, the good she accomplished for herself was twofold. For when the commander of the Attic ship saw that she was ramming a ship of the barbarians, he assumed that Artemisia's vessel was either a Greek ship or one that was deserting from the barbarians and now fighting for the Greeks. So he turned away from her ship to attack others. That was one result to her advantage. She escaped, and she was not destroyed. But another outcome was that even though she was doing harm to her own side, she won the highest possible praise from Xerxes. For it is said that as the king was watching, he noticed the one ship ramming the other, and one of his men with him said, "My lord, do you see how well Artemisia is fighting, and how she has sunk an enemy ship?" Xerxes inquired if it was truly Artemisia who had accomplished this feat. And they confirmed that it was, clearly recognizing the ensign of her vessel, and believing that the one she had destroyed belonged to the enemy. So all that, as I have explained, brought her good fortune, and in addition, no one from the Calydian ship survived to become her accuser. In response to what he had heard, Xerxes is reported to have said, "My men have become women, and my women men."
Wow, there's the great historian Herodotus giving big props to the woman, commander and tactician Queen Artemisia here.
Right, and that is just one of many other stories he tells of clever women, capable women, intelligent women, doing all kinds of wonderful things and often succeeding where men don't. I could give other anecdotes, but it's an element of his cosmopolitanism, his not provincialism, and he's dealing with provincial Greeks, and he's telling them things they don't really want to hear or enjoy hearing, but at least it's foreign women, strange women, faraway women, so they can accept it, and in fact, maybe with a tingle of erotic pleasure, they enjoy it, for all I know.
Ram those ships, baby. He began almost destined for cosmopolitanism by being born in Persia, but then part of the Greek world, the Persian Empire. His life, what we know of it, it reads like a kind of endless wandering, practically exile. Was it deliberate historical research, or was he sort of set out on his own odyssey?
We don't know. He says it was deliberate, that he went to see for himself and to do researches, to do investigations.
Inquiry, I guess,
inquiry
was the word.
Inquiry is the word he uses.
Which becomes history, ultimately. This is the Greek word.
Right. The word historiae, which means inquiries or investigation, became our word for history. And the title of his book is Historiae, which means investigations, but mm-hmm. we have inherited it as the word for the discipline, history. But he went to Egypt. We know he was in Turkey, in many parts of what is now modern Turkey. He says he went to the Black Sea area, and there are some indications that he did, but also some indications that perhaps what he did part of the time was just go down to Piraeus and interview ship captains and learn a lot of things from people who were coming in from those places. We don't know.
Reporters sometimes cheat that way. Wasn't he in Sicily as well, or by the end of his life?
Yes, it could well be, because he died in Thurii, which is a city in Italy, but probably, very likely, he had been in Sicily on his way in one travel or another. He did travel extensively.
Let's take some calls. A lot of people want to speak with you, Bob Strassler. We're talking about Herodotus, father of history, and the histories out in the new landmark Herodotus. Stephen is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Stephen. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I'd like to ask the author of his view on the differences between Thucydides and Herodotus's histories and the relevance for today. And if you don't mind, actually, I'd like to quote from David Hume on the difference.
Please.
He says, the first age of Thucydides, in Hume's opinion, is the commencement of real history. All preceding narrations, specifically Herodotus, are so intermixed with fable that philosophers ought to abandon them to the embellishments of poets and orators. And so that's Hume's view. Today's view, you have people talking about the realpolitik of Thucydides versus the more fabled treatments of Herodotus. And I'd love to hear your author's view on the differences in applications for today.
Stephen, it's a great point and question. You defend, Bob Stressler, the digressions, you call them, of Herodotus as now standing, revealed as cleverly inserted background material. But what about Stephen's point?
I have to first say to Stephen that I'm not the author. They're both dead. I'm the editor. But beyond that...
I'm guessing Stephen knows that. But yes.
I'm sure he does. I've been called the author before by error. I just have to correct it. There is a point, certainly, that Thucydides knew about Herodotus and disdains many things about Herodotus. He says, I will not have any romantic tales in my work.
Now,
to
remind our non-historian listeners, Thucydides coming a couple centuries later, the great historian of the Peloponnesian.
He was just one generation later.
Okay, pardon me, one generation.
Their lives overlapped. It's pretty certain.
That overlap, lost
Thucydides
track of.
Must have been born around 460 and Herodotus around 490. So they were literally
almost
a generation
contemporaries,
apart.
One generation, and Thucydides that disdainful.
Very much so. I could read you the passage.
But you're not, and Herodotus gets the father of history label.
Well, there's a point in with all due respect to David Hume, whom I have the highest regard for, there's a point in Herodotus early in Book 1. He starts off talking about the different Asians and Greeks abducting each other's women, and that's he sort of brings up a fabulous idea of how the conflicts arose. But then he says, but I know the first man who really harmed the Greeks. And his name was Croesus. And Croesus, of course, is a historical figure who lived around 550, about 75 to 100 years earlier than he was writing. But it's history. And at that moment, I would say, Herodotus is writing history. Yes, he adds fables. Yes, Herodotus, and you ask about the difference between the two of them, Thucydides concentrates and focuses only on political and military history. That's why there are very few women. There's almost nothing in it about contemporary life. It's all military and political decisions and actions. Herodotus, on the other hand, has a much wider scope for what he calls history. He is interested in what people wear. He is interested in people's customs. He's interested in what gods they worship. He's interested in all kinds of elements of life that Thucydides ignores. And so we have come to accept Thucydides' definition of what history is all too much. Herodotus, I think, deserves much more credit as the father of history.
You write in your preface his omnivorous curiosity, which struck you originally as misplaced, now appears a fascinating and valuable asset to historical comprehension, and the vast scope of his tale in time and territory, which had seemed so bewildering at first, proves in the end to be a fitting background for the epic scale of his climax. You're suggesting that this great breadth of all that he covers, including maybe some of the fabulous, actually fills in the mural behind these historical events to help us understand them more deeply?
Absolutely. And there's an element, too, in which what he did was write down things that he spoke. His Greek is much more spoken Greek than, let's say, Thucydides, which is clearly written. We think of him as a sort of Mark Twain, as one part of his character, that he made his living giving speeches and talking at symposia, at parties, and after-dinner speaker.
And scribes would take it all down.
Well, no, he sat down at some point, I think, and said, now let's write it down.
I see.
That's my guess.
Okay.
We don't really know.
This is my opus.
But I can hear him saying at a drinking party, well, that's a really good story. I can top that. And then topping it. And he took his best stories, and he would say, well, this is what I heard.
Mm-hmm.
He wouldn't say this is fact. But he would say, here's something that I heard that I think I should tell you about. And then he would tell some fabulous story. It helped to make it interesting. We have to recognize that both of these authors lived. Their works are still here after 2,500 years. They both
Not too
have
bad.
Wonderful qualities.
Let's take a call from Glastonbury, Connecticut. Bot, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Actually, my question is two-part. I have read Herodotus long time ago, but, I mean, some of the things, as I'm from Pakistan, at which that time was India, he does make some comments that are very, like, racist. He says, he wrote that Indians had black semen, which was when Alexander the Great conquered India, he went back and said, no, that is not the case. And other stories about diamonds being mined by huge ants. And so I just wanted to know if stuff that seems from our point of view sort of derogatory, even to Xerxes, like he was one of the best emperors. He was at that point so progressive. There was no forced religion in Persia at that time, and he's still revered by the Iranians and other cultures of that area. So I was just wondering if that made into the translation, did you translate it as it was, or did you have any notes or notices?
It's a great angle of inquiry, but let us look at it. Bob Strassler, how about it? You describe him as a great cosmopolitan. Bot says, yeah. Well, maybe, but he sounded a bit racist to me when he described India, for example. Is Xerxes a villain or a progressive emperor?
He did not think that it was wise to have a single man rule over others. And so he ascribes to Xerxes many faults, which, of course, he didn't know Xerxes. He never spoke to Xerxes.
But very Greek in that perspective.
Exactly. So Xerxes turns out to be unable to accept good advice often enough. Xerxes is often wantonly cruel and randomly disorganized and quick to be frightened and quick to be, which is, of course, not true. I don't believe for a minute that his picture of Xerxes represents reality at all.
Did he slur Indians, Egyptians, by the fabulosity of his reports?
She raised the question of the big ants that mine
the gold-digging ants.
But
know.
That there seems to be an explanation with that in Pakistan, in the Indus Valley. There are marmots. They're like groundhogs, and they dig burrows, and this was discovered in the 19th and early 20th century. These burrows, if they dig into a certain gold-bearing sand, when they kick the excavated dirt out, it tends to collect gold at the burrow's mouth. And so there is some kernel of truth.
That's
in
on
this
the
idea.
Fabulosity front.
Right.
What about on her racism front, reports of black semen? This sounds like a kind of...
Oh, that was Colchians, not Pakistanis. People lived on the Black Sea. And, of course, it's ridiculous. I don't think he believed it for a minute. He did say some things once in a while that I believe he didn't believe, and he was pulling our leg. For example,
to spice it up, to keep you reading, to keep you at the Cracker Barrel?
Because it was interesting, because people would like it. I mean, he wanted very much, he knew what they liked. He knew they liked, for example, it's a very interesting element, they wanted to know where he got his information. He said, oh, I heard this from a Greek. I heard this from an Egyptian. I saw this, and he tells where, and it was confirmed by so-and-so. So he's interested in explaining his sources, which is the first writer we know of who was interested in doing that at all.
And that puts him in the vein of a true
That's
historian.
Basic history, yes.
But I hope that gives you some satisfaction right there. But what about in translation this time? When you go to
we
the fabulous stuff.
We took it straight. We did not bolterize or change anything. We tried very much to be fidelitous to his text. If he said something that was ambiguous, we left it ambiguous. We put a footnote and said, he made it ambiguous, not us. But we kept very much to his text as it was. So if she finds that to have the racist slurs, I'm sorry, I do not. But it may well be. It's in the original.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the father of history, the great ancient Greek Herodotus, his fantastic world of wonders and marvels, and the very real affairs of men and women and war. He set out to explain, to inquire into the origins of the Greek and Persian wars. Out of that came the histories, his inquiries. Robert Strassler has now brought out a big new volume replete with appendices and maps to make it all very real and very accessible. It's still incredible history all these centuries, now millennia later. Let's take a call, Bob, from Denver, Colorado. And Joe, hi, Joe, you're on the air with Bob Strassler.
Hello, Tom, and hi to Mr. Strasberg.
How are you?
I really agree that I think even in our own investigations today, we're still going through that same process that Herodotus was. And what intrigued me about you guys' conversation was his travels and how that played into what, you know, his passion and what he wanted to write about. So I was curious if you've traveled in this area and have seen something like recently I heard about in Georgia, you know, they confirmed this idea of Jason and the Argonauts and the Golden Fleece, because even today they're still mining gold, you know, along these creek beds with the hides of the sheep. So I was wondering if you've also had some personal experiences that play into your passion and inquiries here.
Joe, thanks for that. Robert Strassler, have you gone on the trail of Herodotus, physically, geographically?
Been in Greece, Italy, Sicily, North Africa, Libya, Egypt. Certainly, you see things in Egypt that he saw and wrote about.
Such as?
Well, the pyramids.
Yeah,
the great pyramids.
They've lasted.
The fantastic, unbelievable structures. I mean, the Great Pyramid of Giza is 50 stories high. It's of solid blocks. Mm. And imagine what, here's this man who knows a Greek temple. It's a beautiful one. But looking at that, that's simply absolutely fabulous. And it was built in great antiquity. Even in his day, it was almost 2,000 years old. So it's, I've had the same awe and same wonder. And I mentioned how he might pull our leg from time to time. There's an anecdote, if I can just digress a second, in which he sees a sign, a plaque on one of the pyramids, and he asks the guide what it says. It's in Greek hieratic or hieroglyphic speech. And the guide says, this is a list of how many onions and garlics and leeks were consumed by the men who worked for 20 years building this pyramid. Now, he was a cosmopolitan smart guy.
Yeah.
He would know that you don't put a sign up saying how many garlic, and you know, you'd put something else up saying it cost $20 jillion
right.
or it took, but you don't say. So he passes that on to us, and we don't know whether he's pulling our leg or whether his leg got successfully pulled and he just thought he'd pass it on to us. He was amazed by Egypt, by its antiquity.
The annual flooding of the Nile, speculated about the origins of the
right.
Nile.
It brought out the scientist in him very much.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, there's an anecdote I can give also about, I can read a passage that indicates his interest in scientific inquiry and also perhaps the limits of his geographical understanding.
Oh, good. Set it up for us. What have you got?
This is in Book 2, chapter 42. And it goes as follows, and I'll explain it when I finish.
Mm-hmm.
The first man we know of to have discovered that Africa was almost completely surrounded by water was Nekos, king of Egypt. He sent some Phoenicians off in boats with orders to sail around Libya and back through the Pillars of Heracles, which of course are the Straits of Gibraltar, into the Mediterranean Sea, and to return by that route to Egypt. And so the Phoenicians set out on the Red Sea and sailed the Indian Ocean, and whenever autumn came, they would put into shore at whatever region of Libya they happened to have reached in order to sow seeds. There they would wait for the harvest, and after reaping their crops, they would sail on again. They did this for 2 years, and in the third, they came around through the Pillars of Heracles and returned to Egypt. They mention something else, which I do not find credible, though someone else may, that when they were sailing around Libya, the sun was on their right side as they went west.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he lived in the Northern Hemisphere all his life.
Of course.
And in the Northern Hemisphere, particularly above 23 degrees, the sun is always on your left when you face west.
Yes.
But if you live on a sphere, and there were Greeks of his time who thought the earth was a sphere and could have explained this to him.
But they didn't hang out at his bar.
He didn't know about them.
Right.
If you were 23 degrees south and you were going west, the sun would always be on your right. So this particular detail, which causes him to doubt their veracity, in fact confirms it for us.
Herodotus, the scientist and historian. Bob Strassler, how on earth did you, I mean, I know you studied the classics in college, but, you know, you've done something that I'm guessing many people dream about. You go out, you have a successful business career, you spend a lot of time working in the oil business and others. And then suddenly you're back in a university setting and you're delving deep into these classics. You yourself end up as the editor of great new volumes with practically pyramid-building-sized teams of scholars working under you putting this thing together. What brought you back to this super enthusiasm for the classics?
Well, I was invited to teach at a little college in the western part of the state called Simon's Rock College. It's part of Bard College now.
Out in western Massachusetts.
Western Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. And I taught Herodotus and Thucydides, Homer, some of the plays, some of the other historians. And I discovered that the students had a great deal of trouble staying with Thucydides and Herodotus. And I decided, as far as I'm concerned, nobody should be intimidated by these works. They're quite easy to read. The problem for people today, imagine if Herodotus appeared tomorrow, how much we would have to teach him about the modern world as before he could function.
He wouldn't know our reference points.
He wouldn't know what a green light was.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by a green light?
Mm-hmm.
It means we can go, but how would he know? So if, in the same converse way, when he writes about his world, there's a lot of stuff we don't know. We don't know anything about, or very little about, pagan religious rites and attitudes, animal sacrifices, the tactics of commanding warships that are powered by oars.
Mm-hmm. Now,
these are all very foreign to us. And so we have to provide the modern reader, an intelligent modern reader, with a lot of background and context so that he will understand all the things that Thucydides or Herodotus took for granted because they were very common elements of their life and they didn't bother explaining them to their own citizens. And while they wrote for posterity,
mm-hmm.
and they mentioned that.
Very much as the Greeks described.
As Homer.
Troy and all these, they described themselves as fighting for a reputation in posterity.
But they had no idea, of course, how much human life would change in 2,500 years.
It's a long time.
And who can blame them for that? Who today would guess what human life will be like in 250 years? I doubt there's anybody around who would dare to try.
I wonder if you can imagine the passion that one, sometime oil man, now classicist, returned the passion he would feel all those years later. And I was struck, you remind us that in a way we are direct, our direct line of descent from his intellectual world can be traced. You say we're the cultural heirs of Herodotus and the other ancient Greek writers. And you say, for better or worse, our concepts and vocabularies for many disciplines, and here you're talking about history, medicine, philosophy, math, and so on, have come down to us from those ancient Greeks. For better or worse, that struck me. What's better? Well, what's worse?
Well, what's
Are we
better
trapped
is it's,
in a framework
it's
here?
Extremely rich. We have a tremendous vocabulary of abstractions and wonderful works by men who originated the field, as Herodotus originated, in a way, history, and it's a masterpiece. You can say it's better or worse than Thucydides, but nobody argues that it's not a masterpiece.
But you're reminding
what's
us
worse?
It's a particular framework. It's not descended from, let's say, Chinese or
no.
South Asian.
There
it's
are
Greek.
Other frameworks that might have an easier time explaining or living with certain what to us are paradoxical elements of the world. For example, we have problems with what's called the particle-wave duality. We have a particle and a wave as separate concepts inherited, incidentally, from the Greeks. But we have no way to put them together in our minds, and we just have to swallow hard and accept the fact that light and many other elements illustrate or show particle elements and wave elements at the same time.
So breaking through and understanding the world in its true subtlety, nuance, complexity, well, we may still be in a bit of a Grecian cage, even if it's been a great advantage.
Exactly. We have, in other words, we have to live with its limits and try to transcend them from time to time. And why not? They lived 2,000 years ago, and they developed this a long time ago without the help of, and yet they have atoms. They have all kinds of marvelous concepts about the world that turn out to have applicability even today.
So powerful. I remember standing in Athens a couple of years ago and looking out across the rooftops at the Parthenon, and I could feel exactly this, the way in which our very way of thinking is kind of defined, made glorious, but also limited by that wonderful architecture. Shelley's calling from Attleboro, Massachusetts. Shelley, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you, Tom, for taking my call, and this is a fascinating discussion. My question is about the political aspects of what Herodotus wrote about. I'm wondering if he, understanding that people would be hearing his tales, would added some bit of propaganda to his work to embellish certain things to sort of put his country and the work of his countrymen in a particular light. Do you feel that there was this sense of propaganda in some of what he wrote?
Bob Strassler?
Well, he was very favorable to the Athenians. He was very favorable to democracy, and he was very opposed to a tyranny or autocracy. So as I said earlier, he made Xerxes look bad. He remarked that the Athenians, after they had gotten rid of their tyrants and became a democracy, suddenly became very much better at everything, including warfare, incidentally, than they had been able to do when they lived under tyrants. So he certainly had his biases. He certainly had, I mean, he was a human person with all kinds of feelings, and he even said that Athens had been responsible for the victory and that he knew this would be an unpopular attitude in Greece. Well, Greece tended to credit Sparta with having turned back the Persians, but he thought the naval victory, which was inspired by Athens and by Athenian leadership, Themistocles, was really the decisive element in turning back the Persians. And he said so, and he said, I know it'll be unpopular, but this is how I feel about it. So he may well have had attitudes, and yes, I would not say he didn't, but in fact, it's very difficult for us to say 2,500 years later that he was actually making propaganda for one side or the other.
I mean, at the heart of your analysis is this sense that he actually credited the other, well, the barbarians, whether they were Persians or whomever he studied, for the accomplishments that they had made. But what about the Greeks who looked back on his work? Who was it? Was it Pericles who had a kind of a dismissive thing to say about her?
Pericles left the Persians out of his calculations, and it was a big mistake on his part. Mm. But his strategy did not, in effect, pay attention to the 800-pound gorilla in the room, which was Persia. Mm. He just thought of it as a duality, Athens and Sparta. And he devised his strategy in just that small world. And in fact, the Athenians were defeated by the Persian intervention on the side of Sparta more than anything else.
Mm. Let's go to John in Danvers, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I took Thucydides on a vacation recently. I figured that way one book would lighten my load instead of taking a dozen books.
Though it's a pretty big book.
And I came across a dramatic story toward the front. I hope I have this right. It's about a kind of a convocation of the allies of Sparta. And they're talking about whether they should go to war with Athens.
Mm-hmm.
And in that time, the representatives of the towns are very hot to go to war, and there's a king, I think...
Archidamus.
Who was king of Sparta, perhaps?
Yes.
Archidamus.
He was advocating strenuously against voting to go for war. And I thought, this is a remarkable story. Here we have the king of the leading town in the alliance, arguing against the representatives of the other towns. And I thought, this is really kind of a democratic representative assembly going on here.
Mm.
And the leading authority is advocating against war. And it didn't sit well with me that this story didn't rhyme to me and my knowledge of history, especially given our own recent history of entering two wars in rapid fashion. So I wonder if Thucydides was first on my list. Obviously, I'm going to follow up with Herodotus, so I can't speak from that point of view. But what do you think? Was Thucydides embellishing the situation, or what could be?
John, our time is short. Bob, what can you say on another historian?
You're mischaracterizing Archidamus' attitude. He did say, we're not prepared. There's no way to go to war now. How will we defeat Athens? We have no money. We have no this. We have no that. And what he really advised was that we postpone the decision and prepare ourselves in a better position to go to war later. And I think that's a perfectly reasonable position for somebody to take. And I can think of, let's say, 1940, 1941, the Allies, Britain and the United States, taking similar positions.
I want to get one more very quick one. Middletown, Connecticut. Andy, we've only got a couple of minutes, Andy. I'm sorry it's so late, but give us yours.
Hi, Tom. First of all, I'm a professor of classical studies, and I want to say how much I admire Bob Stressler and both the books, The Thucydides
Wonderful.
And Herodotus. And I'd be interested to hear what Bob Stressler has to say about Herodotus' larger sense of warning to people in power not to push too far, that what you can have, you can have for only a short time, and then if you try to push it too far, it'll be taken away from you, and I'll take my comment off the air. Thank you.
A lesson for the ages. Thank you, Andy.
He was
Bob.
Certainly writing at a time when the Athenian Empire was being developed and was becoming, if you want, tyrannous and arrogant and taking extreme positions.
The democracy itself becoming a kind of tyranny.
It's a paradox that Athens was a democracy, the most full democracy that we've ever seen, but it ruled over others in a tyrannous fashion. And that's the kind of Greek paradox that the Greeks loved, whereas the Spartans were not a democracy, and yet they had very democratic or at least constitutional checks and balances that controlled the vagaries of policy. I think that Herodotus was warning the Athenians in looking at the behavior of the Persians, that this could happen to them, that this was the direction that Athens seemed to be going. And it may not be an accident that he left Athens before all this happened. And, of course, he died before the end of the Peloponnesian War. But it's as if he foresaw that they were extending themselves and going too far and were going to suffer from hubris, just as the Persians had done.
And with that, perhaps the father of history whispers in our ear 2,500 years later, Robert Strassler, keep on working, keep on bringing them out. It's wonderful speaking with you. The new book, edited by Robert Strassler, is The Landmark Herodotus. Thank you so much for being with us today.
It was a pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.